Isabella, so I've chosen Blue Lady as our tea today, one of our 27 teas in the building. I thought it was a good idea because aren't you talking about blue stockings or blue socks or blue something? Blue pieces of clothing.
Yes, I am. That's exactly what I'll be talking about. It's to do with the suffragettes, you know. No, it's not. It's to do with the salon culture. Sorry, I'm getting myself mixed up with S's. It's been a long day.
You're just getting excited, aren't you?
I'm just getting, yeah.
Because I know you've been researching this. It's got to be the Blue Lady this episode.
It smells great. It smells good.
Yeah, I'm going to sip it too. So before we talk about the historical stuff that we're going to talk about, obviously we like to have a wee warm-up chat. And I thought that because we are going to be talking about temperance and suffragettes and also cocktails later on at the end of the podcast, a bit of Victorian chat about that. I wanted to ask you about, in terms of temperance, non-alcoholic drinks. What's your favourite? What would you go for? And I don't want to hear Coke or lemonade. I don't want to hear that.
I love a peach iced tea.
Nice. I've got a soft spot for all those weird, like, I'm going to say like root-based drinks. You know, like dandelion and burdock. Sarsaparilla. I don't know what sarsaparilla is.
Sarsaparilla.
That's a drink, isn't it? And you know, when, like in films, when you see like them go into a bar and they're like club soda. I don't know what that is.
But... That's just soda, but they say club soda in America, I believe.
So it's not like cream soda?
No.
When I was a kid, that's what I thought like Humphrey Bogart was asking for in like the Maltese Falcon, the film noir. He was having a cream soda.
Whilst that would be more interesting, unfortunately, no.
Dreams dashed. My opinion of Humphrey Bogart completely changed. Right, so let's crack on. Let's talk about what we're here to actually talk about. So welcome everyone to episode 4 of Time for Tea 1903, Macintosh at the Willow podcast.
Oh.
This month, we are looking at the other tea rooms, Miss Cranston's other tea rooms. Our tours almost always start by saying Miss Cranston had 4 tea rooms and the original Willow tea rooms was her 4th. But it's a bit of a mystery about the other ones for most people. So I thought we could talk about that. I could talk about that, explain that a little bit. And I asked Isabella to research salon culture because we've got these two spaces. We've got the Salon Deluxe and downstairs in the main tea rooms, the front salon or the front saloon and the rear saloon. So I was curious to know where this term had come from and how it had got attached to these spaces, really. So Isabella, you're all right to talk about that for us, aren't you?
I initially thought it was like saloon, like an American saloon, like pow, pow, going down. But that's not...
That's not what happened
That's
here.
That's not what happened.
That's not what happened here. Leave your horse outside.
Yeah.
Settle your gambling debts inside. It's not that kind of saloon.
Water your horse.
So do you want to tell us a little bit about the suffragettes and the salon culture? Because I think that will tie in nicely to handing over to me, talking about Miss Cranston, who seemed to be a supporter of the women's movement and obviously had these salons. Or was using the word salon. They may not be the same kind of thing in her tea rooms.
I'm not an expert on this, but the salon culture, it's a gathering of people held by an inspiring host.
Oh, so if the host is like really boring, it's not a salon.
Yeah, you know, and also who judges whether that person is inspiring, you know? These salons would get people talking, encourage people to come to a certain space. They can talk about culture, they can talk about politics, history, art, all the good stuff. But that they were basically in the public sphere rather than it being up to the powers that be. Though a lot of critics suggested that it was actually an extension of upper class or a sort of bourgeois society. It did play an instrumental role in kind of turn of the century development on ways of thinking. So for example, the Age of Enlightenment.
Remember it well.
Yeah, so the ages of the salon were dominant. They were called they're dominated by conversation. They're called the Age of Conversation quite often. And women played a huge role in the history of salon culture. But primarily an Italian thing, then a French thing. I think there was quite a famous salon by someone called the Marquis. The pronouncing of this is going to be
just
shambolic. The Marquis de Rambouillet. Catherine de Vivonne. So yeah, she ran it from 1607 until she died, and she basically established the early rules of etiquette, which resembled early ideals of Italian chivalry. But it was all that kind of stuff, you know, all that exciting patter. But the main crux of it was that it was a place people could sit and discuss ideas. Women would actually go and use it as a way to develop a higher education when they couldn't do it. It seemed very fitting for that to have developed into the tea rooms kind of culture, because these salons, as I say, were dominated by a leading woman.
I like that. I like if it sounds like, you know, sisters denied education were just doing it for themselves.
Yeah, right? They were like, well, we'll go down here and we're allowed to go here. It's a safe space for us. It's one of the few places that women were allowed to go. And that links to tea rooms in the sense that obviously this was the first time in a lot of ways that women were allowed at the house by themselves, unchaperoned, and they could, instead of having people, well, other women usually back to their residences, it would be, well, we can go meet at the tea rooms. And then that was a place that they could talk, and then that became a place that suffragettes, for example, found really easy to meet because they were allowed to meet there for the first time, and it wasn't causing too much of a raised eyebrow. Progression, culture, enlightenment, all terms that are synonymous with the salon.
So do you think that's why Miss Cranston named her spaces salons?
I do. I wonder. I think it went from salon to salon being a meeting of people, and then I presumably they would sit, talk together, drink together, eat together. So it was just another sort of hospitality venue type space.
Yeah.
In the sort of way of thinking, brain thread that I had, I wrote salon equals talk. Salon equals tea and talk. Salon equals tea, talk, and overthrow the patriarchy.
I mean, I'm not going to disagree with that.
I just feel like I summarised it. I could have just said that instead of all the rest of it.
Our whole podcast could just be overthrow the patriarchy.
Yeah, well, they would have these conversations and then they'd have tea afterwards. So like, have some tea, talk about overthrowing the patriarchy, have some more tea, discuss some anti-vivisectionist views, because they were all about that as well.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
What happened if you went off topic in a salon? You know, you're supposed to be talking about is the mind the same as the brain? Highbrow stuff.
Yeah.
But then you drifted off into like Pokemon or whatever.
Host would ask you to get back on track.
Oh, right. So there was sort of like a moderator.
Yeah, she moderated and made sure that people weren't being rude.
I think that's a very useful person to have in the
room. It is useful.
I think we've seen, during lockdown, obviously, there were lots of clips of amusing, although I use that word lightly, Zoom meetings that have got out of control and moderators have to step in and tell people.
I think they are incredibly amusing.
Tell people off.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And that's dead interesting, isn't it? I wonder where the salons were in Glasgow, where the people were meeting to.
Well, the blue stocking thing comes from... Well, blue stockings was basically a colloquialism for... Or what, like a nickname? Moniker for intellectual women. And it originated from salons in the UK.
And why blue stocking? What's it mean?
So, I believe it was because black stockings were more formal wear. And the sort of slightly cosier, less formal stockings that they used to wear on a day-to-day, which they would have worn while they went to these meetings, would have quite often been like a more natural colour that was tended to be like duck egg blue, or that's not that natural, so, but like greens and stuff like that, so they called them the blue stockings.
Wow. Yeah, so Isabella's... the reason I've asked Isabella to talk about suffragettes is because, as those of you who visited will know, the Salon Deluxe, Margaret MacDonald chose the suffragette colours to decorate it in, which seemed like quite an explicit like way of supporting the movement to me, and obviously Miss Cranston must have agreed. So, you know, we always...
That is yours, yeah.
Yeah, thank you. So, you know, Miss Cranston is traditional Victorian, but that's quite a bold move in a way.
Yeah. The cool thing about the salon as well is the fact that it is... I mean, this is probably for shock factor as well, but it feels like it's kind of a secret, those colours, because on the approach to the door, everything is white, even the back panels of the glass door, so you don't even see the colours from there. And then you walk in and it's like, boom!
Rights.
Right.
Bring us the rights.
Yeah.
And the cake and the tea. But
exactly.
Mainly the rights.
Right, well, I was trying to link... So basically, I mean, this could be true, but I was trying to link it as in salons equals women being able to talk, and then obviously the whole idea of the Salon Deluxe and stuff and tea and things, and then tea rooms, and then suffragettes meeting at tea rooms.
I think that's probably what happened. Because they're not going to meet in pubs. Or, well, I mean, I don't want to speak for all the suffragettes. Suppose I wanted to bring down the patriarchy. Which I do, actually. I would quite like to bring down the patriarchy. I probably wouldn't, as my first choice of venue, choose a pub full of men in 1900 or so. Because I'd feel like maybe I wouldn't be able to talk to my fellow sisters in a comfortable enough space without someone overhearing and that person being like, Women's rights? What?
Well, this is the thing. Also, I mean, so a lot of men weren't very happy with it. In fact, many marriages were thrown into utter turmoil by women saying that they wanted to join the suffragette movement. Even, I mean, think about the fact that, for example, when Miss Cranston opened up her very first premises, she actually went and said goodbye to some of her friends, supposedly, is the tale, because she thought, this is very rare, this is not very well looked on by some people. So some of my friends might completely disapprove that I'm doing this, that I'm setting up a business as a woman. So she went and was just like, sorry, bye.
Yeah, sorry.
Hope you're still my friend, but whatever.
Think of this like a funeral.
Yeah.
Like I'm dead to you.
Yes. But I found out some interesting stuff about, basically, we know suffrage. Suffrage is the seeking of the rights for women. So the rights for women to vote in elections. Huge, grueling campaign. It started off as a talk, and then I heard someone say, the time for talk is over, and now we need action, basically. So then they started getting a bit crazy, but rightly so, chaining themselves to things, and then there was all the force feeding, but they bossed it. And I think it was after the war, actually, because the effect or the support that women had just in general in the war was very duly noted. It was like, wow, we could not have done this without the work that they've done. And they were slipping into typically, for the time, male roles. So it was like, oh, actually, women can do this. The Representation of the People Act passed in 1918, which allowed women to vote, but it was still only 2 out of 5 women. It's not very well known that actually one of the first suffragette parties was started in Edinburgh.
I didn't know that.
I think it was 1870. And there's some actually really funny... So I think there's some quite famous... Flora Drummond, which she was Scottish, but she had a leadership role with the Pankhursts in London. So I don't know if she was up here first. But there were Scottish branches of the National Union of Women's Suffragette Societies in the main cities and in the rural areas, even in like Orkney. Which is awesome. There was a hilarious story about the suffragettes in Dundee in 1908 following Churchill around.
I know this story. I just
love it. I didn't know about this.
Didn't they throw an egg at him?
Did they? That's not what I'm...
Yeah, they threw an egg at him.
I just heard that he was coming up here to campaign, to stand for election as an MP.
Yeah.
And he was followed by like 27 of the national leaders of the suffragette movement. And at one point he hid in a shed to host a meeting because he was like, I can't cope.
Yeah, so he can't fight them on the beaches, can he?
No.
Big chicken. Maybe that's why he threw in a game.
The big chicken.
Yeah, and there's loads of places you can find out more about Scottish suffrage. I think the Glasgow Women's Library, which is possibly the only library in the country dedicated to women, so it's a really cool thing, has some good details and archives and stuff on there, so you can have a look at that, anybody who's interested. I would love to know if Miss Cranston was a secret suffragette. Well, not secret, but maybe she was like the Scarlet Pimpernel, like a secret rebel.
I'd love that. Well, that's why, yeah.
So, now that we've started talking about Miss Cranston, shall I talk a little bit about the other tea rooms?
Yeah, please, I'm actually really bored with my voice.
Okay.
It's upsetting.
How would you do in the salon culture if you were the lecturer?
Not very well.
So Miss Cranston. Miss Cranston obviously was the owner of the original Willow Tea Rooms, where we are, Macintosh at the Willow today. But this was her fourth and final tea room. So I thought we could step back and look at her three other ones, which don't get as much love because they're not here anymore. Well, I mean, that's not true. Bits of them are here, sort of.
Yeah. Really.
So I'm going to talk through not only the three other tea rooms she had in Glasgow, but also like an added extra, an Easter egg tea room. It wasn't an Easter egg tea room, but I'm using the parlance of DVDs, etc. for like extras. I'm probably using it wrong. Anyway, I mean, Isabella, feel free to say, oh, I knew that, or, oh, that was new to me.
I don't have...
What do you know so far?
I have an incredibly jumbled knowledge about the other tea rooms. Mm-hmm. And every time that I try to talk about one of them, I get it mixed up with another one.
Yeah, that happens, doesn't it? And that makes sense, because actually, so Miss Cranston's other three tea rooms were all around the same area of the city, kind of. So they were like, if you know Glasgow, they were basically like on Buchanan Street and Ingram Street and Argyle Street, which are all very close to each other, really, aren't they? You can walk between them quite easily. Yeah. You used to work in one of Miss Cranston's other tea rooms, but it wasn't a tea room when you worked there.
Yes.
So you know about that one, right?
I do.
That's the Argyle Street tea room, now called Sloane's.
Sloane's, yeah. It's actually, the inside is absolutely beautiful.
Apparently there used to be some initials up in the stone of Kate Cranston, like a C and a C facing like backwards. Have you ever seen that? It might not be there anymore. So she had, so Argyle Street was actually her first, and it used to be called the Crown Luncheon Room. But then it was expanded in 1898, and that's the tea room that kind of was the main tea room for a while. And before she pulled Mackintosh to her bosom, it's not pulled, what do you do when you bosom someone? You know what I mean?
I don't do it that often. I mean,
before she embraced Mackintosh to her corset area. Before she hired Mackintosh.
Yeah, there you
I'm
go.
Just going to go with that.
There you go. If you just keep it
plain.
Keep it PG.
Yeah, keep it plain. Like George Orwell said, just use plain words, guys. Plain
just
words.
Watch out for fascism.
That's what he says. Use plain words, watch out for fascism. Before Miss Granson hired Mackintosh, she had this other designer that she used for her other tea rooms called George Walton. And he did Argyle Street. And he also did Buchanan Street, which was her second tea room. George Walton was very much in the arts and crafts movement. And I thought it was quite interesting that his emblem for his decorating firm was a peacock. Because that's quite an arts and craft bird, isn't it? With the blue feathers and stuff.
Mm.
So he did the interiors for her. And he was known for woodblock wallpaper. But he also used a rose pattern, but it was like a flattened rose. So not as stylish as our, I mean, I'm biased, but not as stylish as our Mackintosh sort of abstracted rose, really. And he used stained glass as well. Apparently he was like a herald of domestic stained glass, because glass had got to be a bit cheaper. So yeah, Miss Cranston was, you know, using George Walton for a while in Argyle Street and Buchanan Street. In Buchanan Street, the second one, we think that Mackintosh maybe did some light fittings and some murals as well. So that was sort of what Miss Cranston was doing at the time before she crossed paths with Mackintosh. So, you know, there are those lovely two lovely tea rooms, and then Ingram Street, which is the one I wanted to talk about mainly. But I'm going to go off-piste away from the tea rooms a bit to talk about the 1901 International Exhibition. Do you know anything about this? So this was like... Well, I've got a quote. I'll give you the quote, and then you should get your picture. So I want you to imagine Kelvin Grove Park.
Yeah.
So for listeners, that's a great big park in Glasgow in the West End. It's fancy. It's nice, isn't it?
Beautiful.
The 1901 International Exhibition, which ran from May to November.
Yeah.
Here's a quote about it. The complexity of organising and mounting such a massive event is hard to comprehend. This was a truly international affair with exhibits and people demonstrating products from all over the world. Of the many temporary buildings constructed, for example, a whole Russian village of 7 buildings was erected. There was a model farm complete with a working dairy, windmill, a grand concert hall, a new sports ground, a 4-lap cement cycle track. Wow, fancy.
A cycle track.
And it was visited by 11 million people.
That is a lot of people.
So it was like Disney World,
but
in Glasgow in 1901. And Miss Cranston had a temporary tea room there, which she got Mackintosh to design. It actually burned down, and then they just rebuilt it because it was temporary. So he designed that. He and his firm, his architecture firm, actually entered the competition to design the buildings in the exhibition, but they didn't win. And I've got a quote here from the judges: "Too severe." That's what
I believe it.
That's what they thought of his design. But it was all right, because Miss Cranston was there to say, do my tea room. But let's visit Ingram Street tea rooms, because that's the one I wanted to talk about mainly, for just not very long, but a little bit of time. Because this is the one that you can sort of visit a bit of now. So Ingram Street, Mackintosh did 6 jobs for Miss Cranston from 1900 to 1912. So he kept going back to make changes into the tea room. So the reason you can sort of visit now is that it closed in it was shut down, the whole building was shut in 1971, and Glasgow Museums gutted it and moved everything into storage because it had listed status. And then if you fast forward to a couple of years ago, one of the special rooms in Ingram Street has been reconstructed, like put together again from the original parts at the V&A in Dundee. So you can go visit one of the rooms in Ingram Street in Dundee.
That's cool.
So it's moved. So our tea rooms, we say it's Art Nouveau, and it's an example of Gesamtkunstwerk.
I can never say it properly, it's terrible.
Right, the total artwork. So all the rooms in our tea room, in the Willow tea rooms, thematically all link together, don't they? In a beautiful way. Now, Ingram Street, in contrast, was like lots of different tea rooms of different styles, because they happened over different periods of time. So there was a white room, which apparently had a balcony and a stenciled tree, and it had two murals, one of which was done by Macintosh and one that was done by Margaret. So that's quite romantic,
isn't
it?
In the sort of walkway.
Yeah, yeah. So the Mayqueen and the Wassail.
They're awesome.
Right, which are lovely, lovely gessos, or murals anyway, that you can go and visit. And because that white room, the colour palette of that white room, some people have suggested, was like the public version of Macintosh and Margaret's new house. Yeah, that they just got married and opened.
That house is white.
It's very white.
You only walk around and you're like, wow.
I know, I would not like to spill dandelion and burdock in there.
Is that your choice at the moment?
That's my main worry, am I? So that's really interesting that they kind of took the style of their private spaces and he put it in this public space. I agree. So he did the White Room in 1900, and then he came back in 1907 to do an Oak Room. Because Miss Cranston kept buying bits of the building around her to expand it. And that's the one you can see at the V&A, the Oak Room.
Okay.
And then he came back in 1911 or 1912 to do the Blue Room, sometimes called the Chinese Room.
Oh, yes, that's in Kelvin Grove, right?
Yeah, bits of it, yeah, and bits of the white one are in Kelvin Grove as well. And he also did a room called the Cloister Room, which is nice, isn't it?
Mm.
So I've written a wee bit of description here. The Cloister Room had arches, a barrel vaulted ceiling, lozenge motifs, and niches of mirrored glass.
So, salon de luxe.
Yeah. And the Blue Room had pagoda-like finials, lattice work, rush panels on the walls, coloured glass, electric lights, and blue seat pads on the chairs. So you can go and see, if you want to, you can go and see Miss Granson's Oak Room, designed by Macintosh, and it's the actual thing, in the V&A in Dundee. So the V&A has been designed by Japanese architect Kengo Kuma. And Kengo Kuma actually talks about Macintosh understanding Japanese design anyway. And we've touched on Macintosh in Japan in the past. So this is what the Oak Room is. So I want you to imagine, Isabella, 47 feet long, double height. So it's a big room.
What?
Yeah. And when they took it apart in 1971... there were 600 panels of oak that they had to number in order to put them back together in the right place. 700 original parts, 2,000 parts in total, and the one you see in the V&A is 90% original.
That's cool.
Yeah. So it was restored from 2015 to 2018. In 2017, they did a practice run. So they found a church and they built it inside the church secretly, like as a practice, before they put it up in the V&A.
That's so cool. Imagine doing that as your job.
I know. I mean, Miss Cranston, successful tea person in Glasgow.
Successful tea lady.
Probably the most successful tea lady, but not the only Cranston tea person.
No.
In the city, because Stuart Cranston.
Stuart was all over it.
Brother.
Stuart was obsessed with tea. The man was obsessed with it.
Well, see, now I've done some research, and yes, he was. But apparently he was also a coffee fiend. So look, let me tell you a little bit about Stuart Cranston, brother of Miss Cranston. So they grew up together in George Square in the hotel, right? And apparently, this is the brief story of Stuart and how he entered the tea world. He, because the George Square was a hotel, a man called Arthur Dakin used to stay there. And he worked for Twinings.
Oh, yeah, I heard about
Twinings. Twinings.
If you had to describe what you thought he would have looked like.
Arthur Dakin?
Yeah.
No idea.
I just had this like image of quite a large man with like loads of, like, with a huge twirly kind of black mustache.
Is this like Captain Birdseye?
Yeah, but with black hair, like curly hair. And I can imagine him with a big cloak sweeping around, and inside his poke, sometimes he's got some tea. He keeps tea in his hat as well.
We'll find out. We'll put it on the website. We'll put a picture. Although he's not a major player in this story. We've given him quite a lot of airtime.
He just seems mythical. The way that he patters in, he's just like, listen, Stuart, How about some of these?
Your destiny is with tea.
Exactly, your destiny is with tea, my sweet.
Like a wizard.
Yeah, exactly. And then he just patters off. Anyway, I'm so sorry for interrupting.
No, I think you did right. And in storytelling arcs, there is this moment at the beginning of stories where it's called inspiration arrives, and it's usually a wizard turns up, like in Lord of the Rings.
Yeah,
says,
I was literally thinking of Gandalf.
Off you go on your adventure, Stuart Cranston.
So
Wizard Dakin, who works for from the magical realm of Twinings, got Stuart Cranston a position as an invoice clerk at Wright, Napier and Co., who were tea, coffee and fruit dealers. And apparently that's where Stuart would go and have a wee swally of tea in the back and improve his palate. So he learned all about tea tasting there. And then, I mean, if you were excited by the name drop of Twinings, get ready. Because after he left Wright, Napier and Co., Stuart Cranston was a sub-agent for Joseph Tetley.
Whoa.
That's two major tea players in one podcast episode we've talked about.
Yeah, was he playing them off against each other?
Who knows?
Or was he just climbing the ranks any way he could
to
get to that tea?
So apparently he had an excellent palate and he loved coffee. And in fact, he invented and patented a coffee roaster.
Oh, cool.
So we always think of him as a tea person, but he loved the coffee. And I mean, that's pretty exciting. But when I discovered that one of his tea rooms was a fruitarium.
Oh yeah, you did mention this.
Which I don't really know what that is. I know what a fruitarian is now, in the 21st century. But apparently Mr. and Mrs. Cranston and his wife were well into the promotion of fruit eating.
Okay, but is it just fruit? Is it explicitly fruit eating?
This is my question.
Are you allowed a banana milkshake? You got a bit of dairy in there.
Like, if you went, could you have a cup of tea or
and
coffee
pineapple.
And a grape? Is it like, if you want shortbread, go to Catherine Cranston's. If you want a grape, go to Stuart Cranston's.
It's just one grape.
Yeah.
A quarter of a grape.
Grapes, the import on grapes.
A
is
grape
really expensive.
Quarter. Yeah, I imagine it would be, actually.
So that's a little bit more about the Cranston Empire. The Stuart Cranston, he had lots of tea rooms as well, and as an importer, he was very successful.
Yeah.
Now it's that special time, Isabella.
What's happening?
When we go back in time to back to the era of the Victorians. Okay, so we opened the top of the podcast by talking about non-alcoholic drinks, but I thought it'd be fun to maybe visit Victorian drinks a little bit. So, Isabella. Have you ever had a smoking bishop?
I don't think so.
So in my research, I discovered that there are these drinks from Victorian times called ecclesiastical drinks, right?
Ecclesiastical drinks.
Yeah, ecclesiastical drinks, which struck me as strange since ecclesiastical is to do with the church. So I thought, well, there can't possibly be cocktails for church people. That seems ridiculous. But apparently the names are to do with sort of the alcohol you use. So the reason these drinks are quite famous is they appear in Charles Dickens. So I've got a quote from Scrooge here at the end of Muppet Christmas Carol, which is obviously the most important Dickens adaptation out there. Scrooge says to Bob Cratchit, "I'll raise your salary and endeavour to assist your struggling family, and we will discuss your affairs this very afternoon over a Christmas bowl of smoking bishop, Bob Cratchit." So to make a smoking bishop, if you wanted, you have to smoke loads of oranges, and this means roast them until they're black.
Oranges.
So you burn some oranges, and then you mix them with wine and cloves, pour them into a big punch bowl, and serve them. So that's a smoking bishop. But if you use champagne, it would be a pope. And apparently, if you use ginger wine diluted with tea, it's a church warden. So there's a hierarchy of alcohol.
I like it.
Yeah. So I was quite curious to find out about these. And I was reading a website by Elizabeth Gabby, who's a wine historian. And she said, in other Protestant countries like Germany and Denmark, you have drinking societies where the punch bowl is actually shaped like a bishop's mitre. And you'd get drunk and laugh at the church at the same time.
Well, I'm sure that didn't go down particularly well in some circles.
So what have you got for me in reply to my smoking bishop burnt oranges?
On here, for the Victorian era, it's called salup. Basically it says salep is a starchy meal originally from the dry tubers of Orchis muscula, made into a hot drink, and you whack some sugar and milk in there. Later substitutes by extracts of similar tasting roots such as sassafras, known in England at least 1712.
So is it like dandelion and burdock?
Oh no, it fell from favour in 1712. It fell from favour.
I wonder what else fell from favour in 1712.
Oh, do you know why it fell out of favour? Because it had an association with syphilis. So the recipe for a gin sling was one wine glass full of gin, two slices of lemon, three lumps of sugar, and four cubes of ice.
That's so bad for you, everybody. So bad for you.
That sounds great. I'm not saying you should do it, but if you did do it, can I come?
You can have a smoking church warden. Remember, that's ginger wine diluted with tea. Great, so we've pretty much definitely run out of time. Thank you very much, Isabella, for joining us. If you, listeners, dear listeners, if you have any knowledge on Victorian cocktails, or Miss Cranston's other tea rooms, or suffragettes in Glasgow, and you want to pop it and share it and pop it in the box on the website, that would be lovely.
And if you'd like to make a booking with us, you can email bookings@macintosh@thewillow.com.
Lovely. So that's pretty much it. So we will see you later.
See ya.
But not see ya, because it's a podcast.